From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Certainly, we will always be mourning these people. It will be in our memories forever. But it will not prevent us from finding and holding responsible the culprits behind this tragedy.
That was Russia's President Vladimir Putin Monday, after Moscow announced that the October 31st downing of an airliner over the Sinai was the result of an act of terrorism. Putin said Russia will act in accordance with Article 51 of the UN Charter, which reserves to member nations the right to self-defense.
We will act in line with Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which provides for self-defense of the states. We hope that our partners will help identify and punish the criminals. Anyone who will attempt to assist the criminals must be aware of the consequences related to this. They will be in charge of these consequences. So I'd like all of our security services to focus on these activities. And certainly I will monitor the and the combat mission of our air force in Syria must not be simply continued, but it must be intensified and bolstered in a way to ensure that the criminals would realize that punishment would inevitably come. And I would like to instruct the General Staff and the Defense Ministry to provide their own proposals on this issue.
Russian media reported Tuesday that Federal Security Service Director Alexander Bortnikov had told Putin that investigators found traces of a, quote, foreign-made explosive substance, closed quote, which detonated during the flight, downing the plane. He said the bomb was a, quote, homemade device with the power of 1.5 kilograms of TNT, closed quote, according to the report. According to Reuters, security officials said Egypt is holding two employees of Sharm el-Sheikh Airport on suspicion of assisting those who planted the device on the Russian Metrojet plane on October 31st. Also on Monday, France's President François Hollande called for changes to the French Constitution that would grant his office special powers after a declaration of a state of siege. The proposed changes to Article 36 of the Constitution, which provides for the imposition of martial law for a period of 12 days without parliamentary approval, would allow the implementation of additional extraordinary measures, including the revocation of citizenship.
We should be able to enable someone who has attacked the fundamental interests of our nation or committed an act of terrorism, the person must be, we must be able to deprive that person of the French nationality on the condition that the person has another nationality. We should also be able to prevent someone with dual citizenship from returning to our territory if the person constitutes a risk of terrorism.
And U.S. President Barack Obama spoke with the press Monday at the G20 summit in Turkey.
The vigilance that the United States government maintains and the cooperation that we're consistently expanding with our European and other partners in going after every single terrorist network is robust and constant. And on the diplomatic front, we've been consistently working to try to get all the parties together to recognize that there is a moderate opposition inside of Syria that can form the basis for a transition government, and to reach out not only to our friends, but also to the Russians and the Iranians who are on the other side of this equation, to explain to them that ultimately an organization like ISIL is the greatest danger to them, as well as to us.
The question of self-determination looms large over Syria, with Russia saying that only Syrians have the right to determine their future. Elites in the U.S. have always had a problem with that issue, including the right of self-determination for groups within the United States, in particular, black Americans.
This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody. America today finds herself in a unique situation. Historically, revolutions are bloody. Oh, yes, they are. They have never had a bloodless revolution or a nonviolent revolution. That don't happen even in Hollywood. You don't have a revolution in which you love your enemy. And you don't have a revolution in which you're begging the system of exploitation to integrate you into it. Revolutions overturn systems. Revolutions destroy systems.
Malcolm X's call for black self-determination remains widely misunderstood in the U.S. and still unrealized. For more on that, we spoke with Danny Haifong, who wrote an article for last week's Black Agenda Report on the question of self-determination. I want to start with your piece in this past week's Black Agenda Report on the issue of self-determination. The title of it is pretty self-explanatory. Self-determination, what it is, what it isn't. Why don't we start with that key question?
Sure. In the article, I trace the last year of resistance to police brutality in the United States and try to link it back to a particular moment in history just decades ago where, you know, the Black Liberation Movement and the internationalist struggle around the world against imperialism were drawing some pretty deep links to each other. And given everything that is happening around the globe and given the exacerbation of police violence against Black people, as well as the havoc that imperialism is creating around the world, it only makes sense to begin to talk about what self-determination is and try to get it back into the narrative of the movement. I define self-determination in the article through the lens of revolutionaries like Vladimir Lenin and Kwame Nkrumah and Malcolm X, who defined it as the ability for an oppressed people to develop independently from a foreign occupying force. And, you know, in this period today, the same occupying force that they were talking about, imperialism, remains the key issue, the system that dictates the happenings that are going on in Paris, the war that's raging on in Syria, and the daily deaths of Black people in the United States. So, you know, the article really tries to hit on all these points and come to a conclusion that we need to begin to talk about self-determination because there are currents and sort of ideological variants within the movement today that are more dominant, in which self-determination is more defined as, you know, just any decision that a group of people may make, whether that's voting for Barack Obama or supporting unsavory leaders within, a subsection of what we term the Black Lives Matter movement. So the article really tries to hit on all of this to conclude that self-determination is a critical principle that is not yet realized and needs to be discussed if we're ever going to develop a movement around it.
I mean, you cite Lenin, for example, and he's been gone for 91 years, I think, if I get the arithmetic right in my head. And and yet he had a rather concise and, looking at it in hindsight, profound analysis of the need for self-determination and the relationship of any revolutionary activity to the situation of people in what we now call the Third World, but then the colonial world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and he had a keen sense of understanding that if self-determination wasn't supported by revolutionary forces, whether that they be in the Soviet Union, the socialist state, the Soviet Union, or anywhere around the world, that unless self-determination is supported, unless the peoples of the world who are trying to free themselves from the chains of imperialism is supported, then ultimately what will occur, and this is what Kwame Nkrumah was able to conclude, which is that what happens if self-determination isn't supported is neocolonialism and the rule of you know, the formerly oppressed bourgeoisie, the new ruling class with maybe a black face, maybe a native face, but still subservient to the foreign power that once colonized a nation. So Lenin was most concerned about how to build a world revolutionary movement that could ultimately expel the colonizer and bring about the conditions to destroy and ultimately transform the system dictating the colonizing powers, which is capitalism and imperialism.
And Lenin, you know, anyone familiar with his works, of course, understood that he was a big fan of substance and not fooled by form, and would point to substance as the, you know, or essence as the thing to be concerned with. And so when you change from colonialism to neocolonialism, if you have perhaps the appearance of bourgeois democratic forms in a country, but the control of the means of production and of the economic life of the society still in the same hands, that nothing really has changed. You know, with that in mind, and taking into account what you just said, this is kind of a critical question right now that's before, I would say, the left, certainly, but really before everyone, looking at the international political situation. There are many on the left that criticize countries like Venezuela, for example, and even more so, say, Argentina, Brazil, China, from the left, in a way. These are, you know, there's been capitalist revival, these are capitalist rotors, whatever criticism is leveled at them, and therefore they are not to be supported against the United States in the international struggle, because they're just another capitalist power, without taking into consideration that the United States and its grouping are the imperial powers around the world, and that taking them on with whatever allies you have is the anti-imperialist struggle, leads to the at least the potential for self-determination around the world elsewhere, and then moving forward.
Exactly, and unfortunately, at the recent UN General Assembly, I got word from friends of mine and people out there in New York City that there was a section of the left protesting against China. Outside of the building, the UN building, and that is very troubling, and it speaks to what you were just saying, in that there is a real lack of understanding, and a lot of it around self-determination, and a lot of it stems from a broad and dominant force in the United States that exists, and that is white supremacy and imperialist arrogance. Because when we think about it, if anyone objectively looks at the conditions and the happenings and events that are unfolding around the world, one could easily find the answer that we are all looking for, which is that the United States and its imperialist allies are the number one enemy. And we can also, conclude from such an analysis that China and its allies are actually making moves that will benefit the lives of people in the third world and of people in the formerly colonized regions of the world. One can see that Russia and China are right now the two biggest forces in the way of full spectrum U.S. imperialist dominance, in a time when the imperialist system itself is in a very delicate and sensitive moment, when its economic system is not recovering and will never recover from here on forward, as we have seen and as we live it every day, but also that the repression that it is unleashing around the world is not working in the same way that it once did. It's no longer able to stabilize a neocolonial situation, which would be to its economic and political benefit. right now what we see is it wreaking chaos in Libya and chaos across North Africa and chaos across the Middle East and Syria and Iraq. That's what we have. And China and Russia right now are the two forces in the world strong enough with the resources and with the will and the ideological will to uphold international law. And if we don't defend these countries from imperialist attack, we will be in a lot worse of a situation than we are now, if that can even be fathomed. But yes, it is a critical question. Self-determination is a critical question because, you know, if the left is interested in Lenin or interested in self-determination, then they would understand that there is a need to really defend countries from imperialist attacks, so those countries and those people can really have the chance to develop independently, and we can actually have conversations, you know, on an equal basis, because we won't have the threat of imperialism down our throats. And you know, the left in the United States, if they're interested in issues like police violence in the United States and racism, who better and what forces are better to learn from than all around the world, where peoples have been struggling against the same enemy for centuries.
You know, you mentioned the leftist, quote-unquote, protests outside the UN against China. One of the very important pieces of information that's usually left out of the narrative completely here, but was cited by Barack Obama when he had President Xi at the White House earlier this year, is the fact that aside from offering resistance to U.S. imperialism just by the sheer force of its economy, by standing up in the international sphere, and by taking affirmative steps to help uplift countries around the world, China in the last 15 years raised something like 600 million people out of extreme poverty, affirmatively took that act, an unprecedented one historically, yeah, as admitted exactly. by Barack Obama. The very same, I mean, here in the United States, the left has a city council member in Seattle, a couple of school board members here and there. I mean, the people are, I mean, I want to diminish the value of the struggle that's absolutely necessary and that people do here, throwing their lives right. on the line on a daily basis. On the other hand, certainly not a position of strength from which to lecture people in China. Right. And that kind of echoes the type of criticism that often comes from white people on the left in particular about racism and reverse racism and, oh, there's no such thing as race here in the United States. It's almost the same kind of arrogance.
Yeah. That's interesting that you say. I didn't know that, actually, that Obama had to acknowledge the achievements of China, because I recently read a Guardian article not too long ago that also had to talk about how China has eliminated urban poverty in China, yeah, right. which is an interesting development, given the fact that the Chinese Revolution, its whole purpose, if one studies it, was to eliminate the different conditions that existed between the countryside and the urban areas. Right. And to think that in less than six centuries, or in just about six decades, part of that has been accomplished lends us to hopefully curiosity as to, well, what actually helped made that happen? Was it the dictatorship of China, which is what the left always talks about, and how, you know, undemocratic and, you know, dictatorial it is, whatever the, you know, the real racist response is to China? Or what is it, a real genuine socialist movement that is still alive and well in China that we should really study and understand, because there are so many misconceptions? And what you said is true. I mean, most of this does come from the white left, because at this point we have a movement against police violence where the consciousness is not yet there to make the connections around the world, and we have to be pushing that. But at the same time, for the so-called left that says it is there and says that it is ready to make those connections, a lot of times those connections are riddled with imperial arrogance. And it's almost ironic, given the fact that they will be some of the first to decry police violence in the United States, but won't decry the violence that the U.S. warfare state is waging on peoples all over the world. So, yeah, it's definitely an important question to take up.
And one of the things that seems also to be left out of the left's narrative, or the so-called left's narrative in the United States, when it attempts to critique the nature of China, is the fact that in the last 20 or 30 years, the largest public sector in the history of humanity has also been constructed.
Yeah, and it will be it's going to continue to be constructed throughout the world with the New Silk Road Project and other efforts that China is going to undergo in order to really squeeze. And this is the most important thing about it, that China's economic development model is really attempting to squeeze away the grip and to really weaken the grip of imperialism all around the world economically. I mean, when we think about the billions, the hundreds of billions of dollars it's going to take, out of purely state revenue to build a project of roads and dams and various other infrastructural needs in order to develop these trade networks that are part of the Silk Road Project. It will ultimately be probably the biggest public sector infrastructural project we've ever seen. It's really ironic that the left in the United States, sometimes how weak it is at this point, can point the fingers and attempt to demonize another country finding its way when, you know, we right now are in no position to do any such thing, given the conditions that we're dealing with here in the United States.
Yeah, one would think that they would be sitting in a lecture hall with notepad in hand rather than trying to walk up to the lectern and start pontificating. On top of the Silk Road Project, of course, you have the construction that's now underway or commencing in Nicaragua of the Transoceanic Canal, the construction of deep water ports all across Central South America and the Caribbean, the infrastructure of trade there, the transcontinental railroad that's going to be built by China or with China's help, connecting the Pacific and Atlantic coasts of South America. The infrastructure essentially for an integration at an unprecedented level of the economies of Asia and the Latin American region.
Yeah. To think that China just 6 decades ago was one of the most underdeveloped countries in the world. Imperialism had drained it of all its resources and had developed and really coddled a comprador bourgeoisie in that country to commit unspeakable massacres and atrocities of the native population. And to think now that China is in the strongest position to really build the material conditions for internationalism, because it's a really important thing to understand that in order to overthrow and ultimately transform the system of capitalism, we need room. We need room to breathe. And right now, peoples all over the world don't have that. So when we think about China's relations with countries all over the world, we really have to concretely study what that is, because, African nations, for example, just saw NATO collaborate with AFRICOM and collaborate with the African Union in exercises purportedly against Russia. But we all know that China's relations with Africa have angered the United States, because U.S. corporations are being rejected. They're being rejected in Burundi. They're being rejected in the Congo, because China's economic relations with other nations tend to be fair, tend to be about, you allow China, a particular country allows China to extract certain resources, China will develop the capacity of a particular nation, develop its own infrastructure, so that's a fair trade, unlike how the United States does business, which is to overthrow a particular government and and suffocate a nation with its corporations of pure exploitation and resource extraction out of the country, leaving most countries in too much debt to develop anything, healthcare, education. And so that is really the struggle that's occurring right now when it comes to the war that the U.S. and its allies are waging on China.
And that comes back to the question of self-determination. China doesn't topple governments in order to establish trade deals. And it actually, if you go back to what I think was the genius of Hugo Chavez here in the Western Hemisphere, using Petrocaribe at the beginning and then other instruments of regional integration moving forward, he offered assistance to the people living in various nation states in the Caribbean and Latin America, regardless of the political orientation of the leadership, essentially saying, look, it's your right to have whatever political forces, whatever arrangements you want within your own nation. Your people need oil. Your people need development. We will sell you oil in a way that allows you to begin development and that incentivizes your investment in the uplifting of your people. And rather than backing revolutionary groups and all kinds of other activities that had been done, you know, previously, that was the mode of engagement, and it's resulted in the integration of Latin America and the Caribbean to a degree that had never been achieved before. And China follows a similar model across the globe.
Exactly, and what we see in Latin America is the conditions are being created to where revolutionary groups and movements can emerge and struggle for power within and hopefully, you know, in the future outside of the neocolonial and neoliberal apparatus. That is really the challenge. And Russia, the same way, has been doing the very same thing when it comes to Syria, for example. Syria has received military aid and air cover against the terrorist invasion. But at the same time, Russia is not... has been very keen and very firm in stating what its relations with countries around the world is. It's one of mutual support, but it is not one of political influence. And that is really important to understand, because a lot of times in the United States, when we're in our own movement circles and we're trying to really challenge dominant narratives around imperialist arrogance, or even when it comes to our own internal struggle with racism, you know, we had a really hard time knowing what to do when Barack Obama was elected into power here in the United States, because the question came: well, what's our role on the left? Is it to be really critical and to tell the truth about Barack Obama, or is it to emulate the idea of mutual support, and we'll back off until the forces are ready? And we can't equate those two things. And that's what I think I try to get at in the article, which is that self-determination is about power. We really have to understand this notion of power and who is wielding the power, who is behind certain developments, what is behind certain developments, because that will really tell us where we need to be and what we need to do. When it comes to Barack Obama, everyone all out should have been ready to call it out, because, you know, our first commitment is to the truth. But when it comes to developments around the world, we have to understand that we are the imperialist power. We live in the imperialist power, and we have to critically and really painstakingly understand the conditions that people are going through around the world in order to give the necessary support and solidarity.
Danny Haifong is a member of Fight Imperialism, Stand Together, or FIST in Boston, and a regular contributor to Black Agenda Report. We've been talking about his article there in this past week's edition called Self-Determination, What It Is, What It Isn't. Dan, thanks a lot. Pleasure as always.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.